You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, a look at the politics of abortion in the 2022 midterms, including a vote in one state to put abortion protections in a state constitution. That's today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, Wisconsin played a role in the Underground Railroad as one of the last states along the path from slavery in the South to freedom in Canada. As part of our Why Wisconsin project, a listener named Karen Wessener asked how much Underground Railroad activity there was here in Wisconsin. She's wondering where enslaved people seeking freedom would shelter in our state, what kind of penalty there was for helping them. It turns out people in Wisconsin defied the fugitive slave law, and there's an authenticated stop on the Underground Railroad in Wisconsin that you can still visit and tour today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the Underground Railroad in Wisconsin? Do you know much about our state's history during slavery? Is there a site in your own community you'd like to share with us? That's 800-642-1234 to join the show, 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Keaton Kloss is the executive director of the Milton House, the Underground Railroad stop in South Central Wisconsin. Keaton, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
And Claiborne Benson is the founding director of the Wisconsin Black Historical Society Museum in Milwaukee. Claiborne, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much. It's an honor to do so. Hello, Keaton.
Hi, Claiborne.
Hello.
Now, Claiborne, let's start with our listeners' question. How important was Wisconsin in the Underground Railroad?
I would say it was essential. I think, it was one of the things that encouraged the South or gave them the feeling that they wanted to fight the Civil War. And now we're talking about the Milton House primarily, but there were some other incidents of the Underground Railroad. But I would say from the offset, very few people really know the actual number because it was actually a secret as they made their way through the state of Wisconsin. But in the case of Joshua Glover, when the state of Wisconsin made a decision, or abolitionists and 500 or so folks made a decision that they were going to break him out of jail, it violated Wisconsin's agreement. Wisconsin made an agreement with the federal government in the 1850 agreement, or Great Compromise, as it was called, between Henry Clay and John Calhoun. And each of them represented their prospective portion of Congress to stop expanding to the west. Kansas, Oklahoma, Nebraska, and the North had agreed to obey the United States Constitution passed in 1793, that indeed it would not continue helping runaways make their way to Canada, and they, according to the agreement, would return their enslaved people back to their proper owner or over to the federal government. And Wisconsin did not do that. Wisconsin out in the open. And I won't say to you that Wisconsin's not the only state to do it, because they weren't. But the others snuck and did it at midnight. And when the troops are gone, Wisconsin did it in broad daylight. And it was in every major newspaper in the United States.
Claiborne,
yes.
I want to get more into to Joshua Glover's story in just a bit. But Keaton, you're with the Milton House, the only site we can really go to and tour that was a key stop on the Underground Railroad. Can you tell us a little bit about the story of the Milton House and its role in that era?
Yeah, so we're Milton House is, like you said, the only certified Underground Railroad site in Wisconsin that's still open to the public. So, you know, as Claiborne mentioned, there were certainly other places and people in Wisconsin who are helping on the Underground Railroad, but a lot of those places are now privately owned and not open to the public. And so we were built in 1844 by Joseph Goodrich, who was a Seventh-day Baptist. Seventh-day Baptists in the 1800s, one of their key pillars of their religion was abolition and anti-slavery. And so when he came to the area and founded the town of Milton, he did so on those Seventh-day Baptist beliefs, including the abolition belief. And so he builds the Milton House as a stagecoach inn and then also operates it as an Underground Railroad site. We know of one freedom seeker who came through our site by name, Andrew Pratt. He came from Missouri on his way to freedom. And so kind of like what Claiborne said, we don't know. We know Andrew Pratt came here. We don't know how many others came to the Milton House seeking shelter. And overall in Wisconsin, they figure only a few hundred people used Wisconsin. We were a little far west to be a direct route for a lot of people on the Underground Railroad, but we certainly played a role in assisting people to getting to freedom.
And Claiborne, I know you've devoted a lot of your work to finding these stories and sharing them with the world, sharing individual stories as much as you can. Why is this such an important part of your work?
Well, before I answer that question in terms of my work, all of Wisconsin is what my work as it relates to African American. I wanted to say that the Milton House and up the central corridor, Rockford, Beloit, Milton, and Rock County, up through Waukesha, Burlington, all of those are, and even smaller little villages and farms. Through that corridor is the Underground Railroad. So it's not just in Milton. And then on the far east side, there is Racine, Kenosha. Not a whole bunch about Milwaukee, but going farther north, Sheboygan, even up to Green Bay and Washington Island. Those are the routes the Underground Railroad folks took via stagecoach as they went to the Milton House, but then also on the back of wagons, trains. Those are the routes and the transportation in which they went north. And those two major areas, the Central Corridor and the Lake Corridor, were the primary directions. And there are people even today can cite houses that they were in, but not everybody. I mean, there, if you went to Milton, for example, and I apologize for jumping here, but if you went to Milton and walked down the street where Caroline Qualls raised $11 to be able to go by a stagecoach or wagon to Canada, to a place called Sandwich, Canada, people would say, my house was an Underground Railroad. There's a little hole back there. But in truth, you can't just – they have verified Milton House as being the Underground Railroad locations. But these folks don't have verification, and there's a special thing that has to happen before you can legitimately say that this house is a Underground Railroad. You've got to prove it. It's not just because somebody says it or because they own it. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I got a little, but that's very significant and important when people, because people everywhere will say my home was an Underground Road. I mean, there are small towns, there are farms where people stayed at, and they're just and there one time, and some of them stayed long periods of time. Mm. In fact, there were African Americans who stayed throughout the winter in certain locations. In the Madison area, Washington Island, and they moved on when the spring came up. So there are many little places in which they stay.
And Keaton, I understand the Milton House, when it was a functioning business, was a busy place, stagecoaches and trains coming through, a lot of people there. Can you talk a little bit about how they maintained the secrecy of their Underground Railroad activity?
Yeah, so we were very busy. We had about 25 stagecoaches coming a day, so that's about one every half hour, and then you have a lot of trains coming once the trains come to Milton. So at first glance, it seems like that's something that would hinder working an Underground Railroad site, but in reality, it actually kind of helped hide the activity of the Underground Railroad. So the cabin that we have still standing on our property that has the tunnel connecting the cabin to the Milton House, we believe that basically the cabin was used kind of like as a supply warehouse area for the operation of the Milton House as a stagecoach. So we think that freedom seekers would have been put on a wagon and put underneath supplies for the hotel. And they'd be brought to that cabin. You'd unload all of those supplies along with the freedom seekers, and they would use the tunnel to move from the cabin to the security of the cellar of the Milton House. And so, when you see, you know, if it was just a regular house and all of a sudden there's a wagon pulling up maybe at an odd time of day or odd, you know, an odd day, you might kind of wonder what's going on over there. But because we had people coming and going and wagons coming and going at all different days and, you know, times, it kind of helped cover that because it wouldn't necessarily raise suspicion to see a wagon kind of just pull up and start unloading stuff. So even though it was kept secret, in a way, the busyness of the Stagecoach Inn actually aided the operation of the Underground Railroad here at the Milton House.
We're talking to Keaton Kloss from the Milton House and Claiborne Benson from the Wisconsin Black Historical Society Museum about the Underground Railroad in Wisconsin, answering a listener's Wisconsin question. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about Wisconsin's role in the Underground Railroad? Did you learn much about it in school? Is there a local site that, at least according to legend, was part of the Underground Railroad, a story maybe passed down in your family? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our look at the Underground Railroad in Wisconsin, answering a listener question in our Wisconsin project. Claiborne Benson is with us with the Wisconsin Black Historical Society Museum, and Keaton Kloss from the Milton House, a verified site on the Underground Railroad that you can still tour in Wisconsin. You can join in with your questions, your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you're curious about this, let's bring out a caller now. Pat is with us in Green Bay. Pat, hi.
Greetings and salutations, folks.
What did you want to ask about, Pat?
I have a question for you. Well, you folks have been talking about Washington Island, and my dad was an Islander. My roots go back, related to several of the prominent families up there. And I have never, in all the years that I've been going up there, I've heard anybody ever talk about it. So where, is there any information as to where people went? Because I do know there was one African American when my dad was young up there, but that's all I know about.
Pat, thanks for the call. Claiborne, do you have more information for Pat?
I don't know exactly. Some 30 years ago, I did a survey of all of the historical societies throughout, and there have been writings about then that's something that I need to find, the details of it. But there were silent getaway places all over the state where people endured winter months as they made their trip to Canada in the spring. And so I don't know exactly where up there they were. I wanted to ask a question myself rather put a rhetorical question in the air. If the citizens would ask the question, why did Europeans, many of them, like Mr. Goodrich, knew that he was going to be engaged and involved in the abolitionist activities long before he left Europe. What was their motivation for wanting to participate in Underground Railroad? I mean, they traveled from Europe to Wisconsin with the sole purpose of participating in Underground Railroad and being engaged. As the lady said earlier, Mr. Goodrich was the person that stood out and owned the building, but the support mechanism to make it work came from all of his church members and all of his friends in the surrounding areas. It wasn't something he just did by himself.
Interesting. Thanks for that call, Pat. And Keaton, do we have documents from Mr. Goodrich, the founder of Milton House, or the people he worked with about their motivations, what led them to do this?
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, their religion was a big driver of it for being a Seventh-day Baptist. Again, you couldn't really be in that religion and not support abolition. Now, obviously, you can support abolition and not actively do anything about it. But Mr. Goodrich definitely did stuff about it. He also founded a college here in Milton in 1844, where he brought a lot of abolitionist professors and deans. Sojourner Truth he brings to speak at the college. So he's definitely active in it. And it is one thing, we are unique among Underground Railroad sites in the country. A lot of Underground Railroad sites were run by one family or maybe one person, and no one else in town knew that it was happening. Because of Joseph, his beliefs in abolition, Seventh-day Baptist belief, and a lot of the people founding the town with him were also of that faith. We do believe that a lot of people in town knew what he was doing and were actively helping him run his Underground Railroad stop, which was not necessarily the norm in other Underground Railroad sites.
Claiborne, I want to bring things back around. Speaking of working in public, you mentioned earlier the story of Joshua.
I know that you want, and just give me a minute. Political reasons, were they took the position because of political reasons. It was a thing called free soilists, meaning the economically southern farmers competed against northern farmers. They didn't necessarily like that, so they took to the Underground Railroad and its activities. So that there are all sorts of reasons why Europeans in Wisconsin were active members and participants in the Underground Railroad. And in many cases, you wouldn't actually see their names on rosters, just as she's saying, but they supported in any way they possibly could. I'm sorry, I will answer your question.
That's okay. Now. Yeah, the story of Joshua Glover, you mentioned this was national news out of Racine. Can you tell us, spell out the story of, Joshua Glover in Racine and a crowd effectively freeing him?
We asked the beginning question was how many and what people, and we know of two of them, Caroline Qualls and Joshua Glover, a woman and a man. Joshua Glover obviously is probably the most important one, but Caroline Qualls, 10 years earlier, gathered a lot of attention. In the case of Joshua Glover, the federal government is making a decision in 1850, the Great Compromise, that the North is not obeying the Fugitive Slave Law. That's a constitutional law. That's not just a municipal or state law. And the state of Wisconsin is one of those people. Everybody agrees to obey it. The North is saying we want the South to stop expanding to the West, and the South is saying we want our runaways to be returned. Well, in 1854, the state of Wisconsin openly violated that agreement of 1850, and it gathered national attention all throughout the entire United States. That Wisconsin, in Milwaukee, 500 people actually broke him out of jail and hid him out and took him. And it made their way into the Burlington, Wisconsin, where he hid out for more than 3 or 4 weeks, and then into Racine, where he was working at, and got on a boat and took him to a place called Sandwich, Canada. That's the national picture, and as I said earlier, other states did it too, but they snuck and did it. They did it when it wasn't popular at nighttime and when the soldiers were gone. Wisconsin wanted to make a statement, and that wasn't clearly an abolitionist statement, that the federal government was not going to tell them what to do. This is something that they wanted to do, Waukesha is a regional capital for all of this traffic. It's Waukesha that controls the ships, controls the conductors. It's Waukesha that played the major role in it. And having said all of that to say, that isn't to say that the white citizens that were active in it necessarily liked black people, because they didn't necessarily like them. This just opposed something that they strongly believe that they should fight for, which is not allowing slavery to go on for the four reasons in which I meant earlier.
And Keaton, as we've talked about, so much of this had to be done in secrecy for obvious reasons. What are some of the things you wish you knew, wish you could find out about what happened in the Milton House during the Underground Railroad era?
Oh man, that's a question I could answer for hours probably. Kind of the normal stuff, you know, we know bits and pieces. We have scraps of paper and some oral histories. So we think we know how they moved freedom seekers to the Milton House and after, but we're not 100% sure. We've just had to kind of go with what people have left us. So I wish someone had really written it down, or I wish someone had taken the time to talk to people. And obviously historians just really did not do that in the years after the Civil War, unfortunately. So I wish we knew if there were others besides Andrew Pratt who came here It is cool with Andrew Pratt that he does stay in Milton for about 4 years after coming here. And then he moves up to Wells, Minnesota, which is another Seventh-day Baptist community. And so we actually can follow him. We see him get married and have kids and become a landowner and a respected citizen up there. And, you know, I wish someone had interviewed him and asked him more questions. I wish we had a picture of him. I still have hope for that. But, you know, just kind of that normal, I guess, normal stuff is I wish we had more of the whys and the hows than what we do.
And Claiborne, we just have a minute left. What is something you wish you could find out from back of those days?
There are some grave sites in that area of African Americans that actually died. But the Milton House becomes very popular and well-known. W.E. Du Bois speaks at Beloit College and stays there. Sojourner Truth, as she mentioned earlier, stays at the Milton House. So the Milton House becomes well-known throughout the entire country for its position, that being Mr. Goodrich, what he fights for throughout the entire country. And I'm talking after the Civil War, but nonetheless, that Milton House and the hotel, it registers in African Americans' mind throughout the country.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to both of our guests. We've been talking to Claiborne Benson, founding director of the Wisconsin Black Historical Society Museum in Milwaukee, and Keaton Kloss, executive director of the Milton House Underground Railroad Stop. They're with us today helping answer a listener question from our Why Wisconsin project about Wisconsin's historical role in the Underground Railroad, helping people find freedom coming from the slave south up to Canada, with Wisconsin, for some people, a stop along the way. If you have a question you'd like us to tackle, you can let us know at wpr.org/whysconsin. That's W-H-Y-Sconsin. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it's this week's edition of Food Friday with advice on cooking with the seasons here in the state. And it is a fine season for cooking. That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, the mighty Mississippi is changing. We'll talk to a research ecologist who shares the findings of a big decades-long study on the upper Mississippi. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we learn about the dangers faced by Central American migrants after the death of 53 people in a semi-truck in San Antonio, Texas. First, the Mississippi River plays an important role in American history and culture. Its banks are hubs for industry, transportation, tourism, and community. It's no surprise to anybody who lives on the upper Mississippi River in Wisconsin and elsewhere in the Midwest. Its waters hold all sorts of wildlife, too. Almost 200 species of fish and mammals combined call the upper Mississippi their home. A new report takes a close look at the ecosystems of the upper Mississippi, including changes in water levels, water quality, wildlife diversity, and habitat. The U.S. Geological Survey and several other partners found some room for concern and some good news, too. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If a river runs through your community, if it's the Mississippi or one of its tributaries, how important is that to your community? What problems do you see when it comes to river conservation in your area? Do you enjoy tourism along the Mississippi? Call in with your thoughts, your experiences, maybe your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Kristen Boska is a research ecologist with the U.S. Geological Survey Upper Midwest Environmental Science Center in La Crosse. Kristen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Before we get into the findings, a lot, it looks like, went into this study. Can you talk about the years of research that led to this final product?
Oh, yes, definitely. So the monitoring of the river has been going on for nearly 30 years. And so we have a program called the Upper Mississippi River Restoration Program. Within that, there's a long-term resource monitoring element that USGS oversees, but the monitoring is actually done by our partner state agencies, so the Department of Natural Resources of Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, the Illinois Natural History Survey, and the Missouri Department of Conservation. So they monitor 6 study reaches across the river, and they've been doing so since 1993. And they monitor water quality, fish communities, and aquatic vegetation. We also tied in some other data, including hydrology data from the USGS gauge stations and some land cover data that we collect as part of our program.
Let's talk about some of the findings now. First of all, the amount of water running through the upper Mississippi, leading in some cases to flooding. What kind of things did we find out?
Right. So a colleague of mine looked back at discharge records for a subset of gauges on the river, and back to 1940 in some cases. And what she found was really greater discharge, or the amount, greater amounts of water really running through the system at any point in time, and that those high flow conditions were lasting longer. So basically, there's more water in the river more of the time. And a little bit more so, she also identified a shift in some of our peak mean flows. So typically we see a spring flood pulse in April. It's been shifting further into the summer months, into May and June as well. And this has a lot of implications, because you can think about the amount of water running through the system influences the depth of the water, the velocity of the water, the inundation of the floodplain. It really influences sediment transport. That water is sort of the power that moves sediment. And so it can influence habitat conditions and a whole suite of ecological connections.
What do we know about some of the causes of that increase in the quantity and then the speed of water flow?
Right. So this report didn't go into a lot of the causes, but it does sort of summarize the findings of others. And there's really three critical, maybe driving forces behind these changes. One of them is simply precipitation patterns and changing precipitation patterns, the amount of water that's running or that's coming to the basin. Another one is the rate at which that water runs off into the river. So activities that change either like the imperviousness, so like paving over a field, for example, it increases the rate of delivery of that water to the system. And so we've seen changes throughout the watershed with different land uses. And then we also have engineered structures throughout the floodplain and the river itself, whether those are navigation structures or levees that influence the conveyance of water, kind of forces that water, moves it downstream faster, I guess. And so those things, we don't really know which contributes more or less. It likely depends on each flood event, really, and how that water transpires through the watershed. But those three factors are discussed by several other reports.
Talking to Kristen Bosco with the U.S. Geological Survey Upper Midwest Environmental Science Center in La Crosse, looking at a big new report on the Upper Mississippi River. That's the part that runs along Wisconsin and other places, too. You could join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Now, how about water quality? If I'm reading the report right, Kristen, it looks like there's some positive news there.
Yeah, definitely. Across the system, there's been... most of the system, I would say, there's been a decline in phosphorus. So a lot of this can be attributed to improvements in wastewater treatment, particularly in communities. And we've also seen declines in what we call total suspended solids. Those are the things that are floating around in the river that kind of minimize the clarity of the water. And so we've seen improvements in water clarity and declines in phosphorus. We haven't seen the same in nitrogen, where we've seen mostly increases in nitrogen, except for in the Illinois River, where we have our study reach. Some of the consequences, or depending on how you view it, we've also seen an increase in aquatic vegetation with this improved water clarity, particularly in the stretch of river that borders Wisconsin. And so the prevalence of aquatic vegetation has really increased over the last 20 years, really. And the fish communities have shifted as well with that.
We'll get into some more of the fish species and more wildlife. Let's go to our callers now, though, at 800-642-1234. Karen is with us just across the border in Illinois. Hi, Karen.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up? Yep, go for it.
Yes, I was saw a report with John Oliver on the drought affecting the Colorado River Basin, and there was a proposal that's been floated to drain, put a pipe and to divert some of the Mississippi River west to supplement the Colorado River water basin. And it reminded me of years back when the Texans bought an outlet on Lake Michigan and were proposing a pipe to drain Lake Michigan water for Texas farmers.
Karen, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call. Now, I know there's the Great Lakes Compact that prevents that happening from the Great Lakes watershed. Kristen, I don't know if the report looks at anything like this. Have you run into any proposals to divert Mississippi River Basin water outside of the basin?
You know, I'm sure the idea has been floated. I have not heard of any proposed legislation that would allow that. I think there'd be some hurdles. For sure. There's a lot of people that value the Mississippi River, and so there'd be some controversy, I believe.
Thanks for the call, Karen. We'll go to Jeff now in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. I invite the listeners of this program to come up here to Douglas County, where the headwaters of the Brule River and the St. Croix are in Solon Springs, Wisconsin, and there's a spring right there in the park with a boat landing where you can drink the water as it flows right from the earth. It's crystal clear, it's cold, runs year-round, it's fresh water, it's delicious, and that water comes out of a spring which flows into the St. Croix, which flows into the Mississippi.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call and the plug for your local park there, too. Kristen, I know I saw you covered in the report some of the tributaries. I saw the Black River, the Chippewa River. I don't know if the St. Croix was part of the study.
I don't believe we have, you know, we really focus on the, we collect data basically in the tributaries that come into our study reaches. So we have six study reaches, and the St. Croix comes in a little bit further north than our first most northern upstream study reach, Pool 4, on the river. So I don't believe we have any data, but there are other agencies certainly that collect data on the St. Croix.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Kristen Boska is a research ecologist with the U.S. Geological Survey. Talk to her about a new report on the Upper Mississippi River, how it's changing, what it means for the people, plants, and animals that live along the river. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you live along the Mississippi? Have you seen changes over the years? How important is it to your community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation, meet some of the wildlife coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about the results of a decades-long study of the Upper Mississippi River with research ecologist Kristen Boska from the U.S. Geological Survey. Kristen's based in La Crosse, sharing the key findings and what they mean for people, plants, other animals who live along the Mississippi. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences on the river, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Kristen, before I go back to our callers, can you talk a little bit about the biodiversity in the Upper Mississippi River?
Oh, sure. Yeah, it's a real, no matter what taxonomic group, you know, the birds, fish, aquatic vegetation, riparian vegetation. It's a very diverse system. And really, we only monitor a subset with fish and aquatic vegetation. There's reptiles and mussels and invertebrates and so forth. And it is really both rich in terms of the numbers of species and diverse in terms of, you know, the relative abundance of these different species. Yeah, if you pick up a one strand of aquatic vegetation in the river and look at it closely, it's crawling with life. It's pretty amazing.
One species I know people are concerned about is the Asian carp that's made its way up a lot of the Mississippi River. What are you looking at when it comes to the carp and the damage it's done?
Right. So we monitor the fish communities in six study reaches. Three of those study reaches have silver and bighead carp established, meaning that they're there and they're reproducing. And three of the study reaches, the most upstream study reaches, do not have silver or big head carp at this point. And so what's been really interesting is that, you know, the establishment of these species has happened within the time frame that we've been monitoring. So we've been able to track some of the effects that these species have had, particularly in the LaGrange pool of the Illinois River. So, for example, they're really... they consume a lot of plankton, the small little organisms that they filter feed in the water. And so there's been documented shifts in plankton communities in the Illinois River, and those have implications to other species like gizzard shad that also consume plankton resources. There's also been work that has looked at, that has looked at the competition with like larval fishes and juvenile fishes. We saw declines in forage fishes in this report, which is sort of overlaps the with the establishment of the carp, the silver and big head carp species, where they've established. So that's a concern, particularly because those forage fishes are the fish that the bigger fish are eating, that the birds are eating, and they really serve an important role in terms of like the food web of the river.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Melis is with us in Washburn. Melis, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear.
Okay, great. So my question is related to the increase in nitrogen. I was wondering if your researcher could elaborate a bit on the downstream effects of that, especially with regard to the Gulf of Mexico dead zone sources, and maybe what can be done to address that.
Alice, thanks for the call. Kristen, nitrogen in the water.
Yeah, our nitrogen levels have increased in most of the river, and they are they do exceed sort of the EPA criteria. So we are a very nutrient-rich river. There are implications for that locally, including sort of nuisance algal blooms, potentially even harmful algal blooms that can be, can damage. It can be impactful to human health. As you move downstream, of course, yeah, the Upper Mississippi River Basin contributes to the hypoxic zone in the Gulf of Mexico. And so while we've had noticeable success in reducing phosphorus, as I mentioned earlier, nitrogen is really another challenge and may require, just changes to fertilizers and things like that that are, distributed quite broadly across the watershed. So it is a whole other hurdle to tackle with a more of a non-point source.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to research ecologist Kristen Boska with the U.S. Geological Survey, looking at a big report on the Upper Mississippi River, water quality, water quantity, ecosystems, wildlife, and more. Still time for your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kristen, I know the report looked at habitat alongside the Mississippi River. Fewer forests, I understand, in some key floodplains. What do we see there?
Right. So we've got this amazing land cover data set that we collect decadally. And there's been a noticeable decline in floodplain forest cover over time. And we know that large flood events, like the 1993 flood, result in mass mortality of forests. And what happens when you get these kind of openings in the canopy, where you have a lot of light all of a sudden shining through, is establishment of non-native species like reed canary grass and Japanese hops, which once they're there, it's very difficult to reestablish trees. So some of those areas result in sort of a loss of forest. We don't have the findings from the 2019 flood, which was also a record, long duration flood. But I believe they're working on estimating mortality across the river related to that. So there may be additional mortality or loss of floodplain forest as a result of that in certain reaches of the river.
So floods are damaging forests. Is it flipped around to, are there certain types of riverside ecosystems that kind of slow the flow, prevent that quick increase in water level in a river?
You know, that's more at a watershed scale. The forests themselves can slow the water, you know, once it's on the floodplain. But I think the damage is really in those long duration of the flooding. You know, if it was a flood where it lasted a week and came down, but the 2019 flood, that was, I think, a record flood for much of the river system in terms of its duration. And so it's just the length of time those trees are inundated that's causing the problem.
We heard from Brad in Madison, who's wondering if at the bottom of the Mississippi they're testing for chemicals like PFAS or lead. I know we look for those things in our lakes and other waterways. How about the river?
I believe the Wisconsin DNR is measuring PFAS locally because of some of the PFAS that's been found in La Crosse particularly. And so they're concerned about the, you know, impacts to the fish community and so forth. I'm not so sure about lead. I do believe the Upper Mississippi River Basin Commission, they've put together kind of an interstate water quality component. And I believe they have a report coming out that does dive into contaminants, particularly in fish tissue. So I'm not exactly sure. I think they look at PCBs and maybe mercury. I don't know about lead.
We had a caller who couldn't stay on the line named Kathleen, who says she's 91. She's been on or in the river since she was a kid. Remembers pushing garbage out of her way, swimming in the lake or in the river, excuse me, and says from where she's sitting anyway, it's gotten a lot cleaner over time. Is that a fair assessment? Have we taken better care of the Mississippi River over the last, I don't know, 7-8 decades?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I went to college here 20 years ago, and when I came here to La Crosse, I was told not to swim in the river by people that lived here. And now I swim in the river most weekends. So I think a lot of that has been a result of legislation like the Clean Water Act that has cut down on the inputs of some of our waste materials. And I think most people I talk to that are my elders have seen noticeable improvements, at least to this stretch of the river that borders Wisconsin.
Kristen, I know we've talked about some good things, some worrisome things. Is it hard to give just one grade or a thumbs up or thumbs down to a big river system like the Upper Mississippi?
Oh, definitely. It's a huge system. It's diverse in so many ways, and it's changing. It's constantly changing. That's what rivers do. And so recognizing what is a change for the good or for the less good really depends on what you're looking at. There's lots of different, I mean, even in this report, we go through a bunch of different indicators. And so I don't think I could give the whole system one grade. You'd have to break it up.
Kristen, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for sharing this research with us.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity.
Kristen Boska is a research ecologist with the U.S. Geological Survey based out of La Crosse. We talked through today about a big study looking at changes over time in the Upper Mississippi River. Again, some good news, some points of concern. You could check out the whole report. I think we've got a link up at wpr.org/centraltime. And hey, I'm having Mississippi River withdrawal. It's been a while since I've been there. So if you're there, take a picture. Send it to us right now, ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. The producers can pop it on the screen for me. Again, take a picture of the Mississippi River, email ideas@wpr.org. Coming up after the news, an immigration expert breaks down the dangers Central American and Mexican migrants face when they try to journey to the U.S. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.